imbalance in it. But we're not going through that.
For instance, your identification of frugality potentially could be one of those disciplines. Are there any other ones that seem evident?
Well, I think that the problem with any society is always mediocrity. And mediocrity is not that everybody, we are all limited in our capacity and in our understanding and in our desires. Mediocrity is the fact that we are giving up, or we do not have any reverential notion about the importance of being alive. So we give up, consciously or unconsciously, and then we just float around. And I think when society is in that state of mind, there isn't very much you can do.
You haven't used the word energy much, especially this evening. Don't you see that as a certain imperative, at least at the moment, which may have some great potential in terms of enhancing or alternatively detracting from these evolutionary processes?
Well, if we take the sun as another one of those resources that we can plug at, or with which, through gadgetry, we're going to build our comfort, then I don't think that the ethos really of society has changed. We are still consumers after something, which is very questionable. If we take the sun not only as a furnace, but as a very powerful symbol, or fatherhood, or mother, whatever you call it, because that's what it is, basically, then we go about using this energy with the notion which is more expanded, more transcendence oriented. So my objection to the sub-collective principle as such is that it might do a very good job in heating some water, but it tends to perpetuate what is very much the Western mode, which is be very able at isolating problems and then try to come up with answers. And now we know that those answers are pseudo answers, because it's not that you kill what that you can get from a sun panel, that it's the fundamental thing, it's something else. It's the fact that we relate to that firmness in very peculiar ways. And through those peculiar ways, we might begin to have a little more of a cosmic notion of what we might be and what we might be in for. So the connection with the utilitarian aspect, with the other aspects, which are in a way much more fluid.
Do you have any particular projections as what might happen to this society in the next 50 years as it relates to present conventions about energy? And
well, it seems to me that the solar energy flare is somehow dwindling. Maybe I might be wrong, but I don't know. In part because, as usually when you have a new technology, it defaults, so that makes people worry about getting involved with it. But in part, I think, and basically I think, because we are still very technocratically oriented, and if we know that there is still quite a bit of oil available, quite a bit of gas available, quite a bit of coal available, and we know that science is a magic, can do magics, then we tend to be less inclined for what somebody calls a soft technology or the appropriate technology and so on.
You haven't identified any of the other so-called alternative energy forms.
Well, the great debate about atomic fission or fusion or whatever, I think it's a very timely debate, because evidently there are tremendous risks involved with it. To speak of them as non-natural, it's a joke, because the sun appears an atomic furnace. So the atomic furnace was there a few billions of years before we invented anything else like electricity or the use of coal, the existence of coal and so on. But naturally, since we are young at developing things, maybe this is not a time yet to get into the atomic age. So I don't have objection in principles. I have objections in terms of technology. The ability we have to have a safe atomic society.
Do you have views on any of the other sources?
Well, I'm not an engineer or a scientist, so I would put my feet into my mouth constantly, I guess. The notion that since we have some windy hours over the horizon, we should make use of the wind, I think it's an illusion. We don't have enough wind to do very much. We can fly a few eggs and put some energy in some batteries for but there's not that much there. There are so many investigations in the use of the seas in many different ways, what they can do in terms of energy.
What sort of optimism do you have about the next 50 years?
From the point of view of the use of energy? Or?
Yes, and how whatever those energy sources might relate to consumerism.
But in many ways, I drop a sudden realization and a sudden reality which says that gas is going to be limited. I think it would be very good, very traumatic, but very good. Because it would remind us that the road we have been taken might be not very realistic. Might be very practical in many ways for a minority, but it's not very realistic. So, and this continuous fuss about the standard of living, it's such a incredible thing. If you're from Calcutta or from it's not real.
What sort of directions do you see your own most telling experiment going, namely Arcosite, in terms of growth, evolution, development?
Well, at this point, I'm suggesting a change of tactics, if not strategies. The change is that we don't see in the community or inside a real interest in what we are trying to do.
By community, you mean the country?
Yeah,
so
the people. So I'm thinking of trying to push for what I call a critical mass up at the site, which would produce this demand. And the critical mass would be the setting up of what I call the suburbs or suburban community, which is what we have, of course, many times what we have. And then develop activities and events which would make the site very, very appealing place to be, or to transit, to be transient, or to be restless. And then at that point, it would become almost automatic that you need the bulk, the habitat, to respond to the demand. So you would go from 500 people to 5,000 people through this pressure.
But in effect, isn't that a reverse of your earlier position of wanting to have the structure for the performance?
But we are doing that though, because evidently we started with nothing there, and I decided that there would be a town there. So the notion was that you put something there and then this something is going to pull things. So that's what we are doing year by year. We are doing something and see that there's a pulling power in what we are doing. So I don't think that it's a reversal. It's going about the goal by going through certain funnels, certain devices, which might make the goal more feasible.
Do you have any idea what that critical mass is in terms of numbers of people?
Mm-hmm. What we're working at now, it's a layout which would include between 500 and 650 or so people. But it would include that many people because the facilities would be mainly not the equivalent of a residence, but the equivalent of a space, like a room for each individual. And that's requires some explanation, but it would be for a number of transient people, number one. And then it would, two elements that I'm trying to push for now, it's a combination. It's an umbrella, which is a monastic umbrella. And then on this umbrella, there will be a school of architecture, landscaping, design, and so on, which would be within this environment of frugality and limited means. And then with this architectural and landscaping, also schooling, there will be a training for the skills of construction. So there will be trainings, learning trades, students learning about architecture, and they will be both of them under this, within this environment, for a monastic
format. And do you so see them as key elements in achieving a critical mass?
Yeah, and then beside that we have the design for what we call the interaction of arts, performing arts, media, and religion. So those elements across this process of the integration of art, aesthetic, ethics through the media, we would achieve a very lively setting.
In effect, you see that a component which is one which is introvert and the other which is extroverted.
Yeah, yes and no, because number one, I don't see the monasticism as it was traditionally could be quite different. I see monasticism basically as a good way of suggesting to society that there are ways, there are truer ways of going about living. And I see that as a very important example, and specifically very important for will be architects. For those people which are responsible for the designing of the human habitat. I think it's very, very important.
You don't sense any conflict between the discipline that's implied in frugality and the concepts of
perplexity. No, in fact, if you take the aesthetic process, for instance, that's very typical, and I think it's typical, you find out that what distinguishes the art object is that it's made with almost nothing, and it has a tremendous power. So we are dealing with the most economic and the most frugal location, phenomena, which tells me that ultimately what we are working at is not a cosmogenesis, but an aesthetogenesis, because that's where the utter economy becomes very, very clear and plausible. You think of a sonata or a performance, there's better rule in terms of what we call the left, because it's a nice form. Even for a consumerist society, I was trying to think about how you can equate a piece by Mozart in terms of money. You can come up with billions of dollars. You can come up with just a few dollars.
How do you conceive of what you're doing, both in terms of ideas and also demonstration, within a larger frame of context?
Well, evidently, what we are doing is, in many ways, it's ridiculous, because it's very, very small. It's very limited in every direction, including quality. But that doesn't disturb me that much, because I'm thinking what we are doing more of in terms of a match or some kind of yeast, more than the actual thing. So the triggering is the important thing. It's not so much the, what you might call, the essence of the trigger. Maybe not. The essence of the trigger has to be very, very, has to be great. But that might be buried into a very funny kind of skin. I'm always thinking of being somewhere in a garage and trying to build a flying machine. And, it's a ridiculous undertaking. It just happened that sometimes the machine is going to fly. So the next step is to make a machine to perform more creatively. So not the size, not the impact in terms of what the economy of the region or whatever you want to call it, until you are investigating, it might be, but it's the possibility of a triggering device.
Have we had any encouragement or evidence that there is any possibility of this multiplying effect?
Well, as I was saying, there are no evidences that society is really seriously interested in what we're doing. So for the moment, no. But we had some kind of a breakthrough, maybe small, in two or three communities, the religious community, the media community, and the artist community. Those are the ones that have responded. And that's one reason why I tend not to believe that we should try to cater to the interests of those communities and then reach the critical mass to this. And it's not a mean, it's somehow it's like a coincidence of means and ends, so I feel fairly good about it.
But your contact with those communities has been very much within an American.
It's a big nation. It's a big nation.
Yeah.
And there are indications that the interest, for instance, for the arts is steady building up by substantial.
What particular relevance do you think that these directions have, though, for, let's say, people in India?
Well, as I was saying, if we could come up over there with a frugal community, but very rich in terms of experience, then...
That's what they have already.
Where?
In India?
Yeah, but we don't have it here, we are the ones that are saying 50 of yours new children are needed for one of my child's to make it. So we need to demonstrate to ourselves that we can take lessons from other approaches. So to help the under whatever developed the under consumers, the best thing we can do is to reevaluate our social and our cultural and economic demands, and then go from there. Well, what they have in India is basically deprivation. Fundamentally. And they do incredibly well within that kind of within that frame of reference, but evidently they need desperately need a change.
As we're now celebrating the fifth anniversary of the Arab oil embargo, has that little event really changed your life at all?
Yeah, I don't know, because I think I've always been interested in trying to make use of the climate or the sun, let's say, because I like that. But quite evidently, when the embargo came, I turned around and I tried to pick up from where I had left, you know, maybe 20 years before, or something like that before. So it might have triggered in my mind what I call the two sons of colleges. So,
but in effect, it was a return to some earlier fundamental work that you had done. In terms of your personal life, did it have any effect?
Well, we never had an 8-cylinder or 16-cylinder Rolls-Royce in the hotel. So I think that personally, genetically, I think I'm very frugal. Mm. I really think so. So there wasn't any effort in that direction.
Do you think that it has changed you at all spiritually, in terms of your ideas?
Well, I don't know. I by trying to think about the nature again of reality and the nature of energy and so on, I came up with some ideas which I think are fairly good. And they all somehow cluster about this notion of an eschatological process. Because I need to find a reason for existence. And I better find a reason which is very, very important. Not just a social reason.
Would you like to define the eschatological process? It's a word that not everyone hears.
Well, eschatology means the investigation about ultimate ends or something like that. Or the...
It's the ultimate question.
The ultimate question might be what's... Why did God create us, for instance? My answer is no, forget it, God doesn't create us. We create God. We are creating divinity if we're going to stay with it. So saying, my notion of theology or of religiosity is the opposite of the notion of most of the churches. We are not creatures fallen from grace. We are creatures trying to create grace.
What for you is the eschatological question?
If I see it as very important that what we call justice, equity, harmony, beauty, grace are to be pursued, then I think we have to be very serious about it. And since those things do not exist, they exist only in very, very fragmented way, in very limited ways, we are trying to imagine or to invent or to simulate, come up with a model that suggests to you that there are ways or that there is the possibility for us to participate in a progression that might bring about justice, equity, and so on. And at this point, I found it totally irrelevant to say that the past has been unjust, but if we can only be just from now on, we got the problem solved. I think we need a retroactive kind of justice. Because there's no way that we can ignore the past when we talk about the absolute. If absolute is absolute, the past is part of it. If the past is part of it, we have to find some kind of a guideline or some kind of a model that tells us that the past is going to be present again somehow. And that's why this idea of a consumption of the parameter of time, so that when all time is consumed, it means that all the past is present. And I call that resurrection in heaven. That's what it would be. And only in that case we will then be able to talk about justice and grace and so on. Before then we can talk about partial or risky justice and whatever.
Those are really very bold ambitions for someone who starts off by trying to design buildings.
Well, it's not that I have the ambition of doing anything about it. I'm
no, but the rest of us do.
No, I think that every person needs to have some kind of a guideline, and the guideline is the model that you build on your own, so that you can then try to be coherent with the model has. And if you're not a model, then you're really in a state of
drift.
So it's not the veridicity of the model, it's not the truth of the model which is important. I think what's important is that is the capacity of the model to suggest to you a possible resolution. So as I was saying, I'm not peddling any truth. I'm peddling an anticipation of something. And that's what the religious mind does. It tends to call it revelation, but it's really an anticipation. It's an invention that needs some blueprint that needs implementation.
You had mentioned in your possible plans for Arcosanti the inclusion of a school or whatever for architects and building design. What would distinguish that from the other 100 years?
That's a good question, because I would not be able to do it in my first school. Then or virtual school or whatever.
So what would it be doing up there?
Well, I would like to get people that are more knowledgeable about those things and get them to work at it. But what I think would be very important is, number one, to connect the theoretical with the empirical. So the training of people involved in construction in parallel and in conjunction with the training of the designers or the theoreticians, I think very important. In addition, as I was saying, I would like to envelop those activities at an age which is still flexible and plastic, to envelop those activities with the notion of a different approach than the consumerist approach. And I think among the many students that I've taken to this country, 20,000, 40,000, I don't know, there might be 1% and it might be very similar. But I think it's, I see that as a best of me. But I don't know that the capacity to put it up a school architecture.
But yet, if there were one associated with Arkazandi, it would, in some strong way, be closely attached to some of your ideas.
Yeah, definitely. But also the idea of bringing in churches and religious models, I see it as very important because I think I can have an input in those things. And I think the dialogue or the conflict or whatever would be very important. So there are many facets to this idea. It's not just that you like to put a monk near a students of architecture. I mean, it's more involved than that. Put a monk.
Okay. Just relating this issue of the design of buildings. I suspect you see a fairly clear evolution in your own mind of your development from a stage in which you talked about biotechnic approach to the design of buildings.
Well, I don't know if I'm, you know, people that come here and say, well, this is organic, and then they look at the model of Arkazandi and say, this is not organic. I think that's taking appearances for substance. Mm-hmm. Because if this means that the suburban mode, if this supports the suburban mode, then I would say this is totally inorganic, because it doesn't respond to the organic needs of society. If by organics you mean that there are the Baroque or Rococo or whatever things within a design, then I would say that's not very interesting. That's not even do with really organic I mean. So when I'm told that this is organic and that's inorganic, I say, well, we are missing a point. Unless I'm wrong. That is much more organic because it tries to respond to the really, to the organism of society and possibly of something more.
So you would give that as a kind of a definition of organic, this ability to respond?
Yeah. And I don't think that Frank Rallier was very far from there. I think he meant something. Mm-hmm. That's all. But then the young student began to look at the, you know, at photographs of leaves or crabs or whatever, and then said, well, this is organic, so what I'm going to do is to design something which reminds me of a crab or a leaf or whatever. Well, that's the least organic way to go about designing organic buildings.
I'm running out of questions.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Do some of you have some questions you'd like to?
Yeah, I have a question. From your thing there, you also mentioned later on about your concept of time. I find it a little, I don't quite understand. You say that eventually all time will be compressed and will exist at once. So it seems that in that sense, the present is also existing at that time. So there really is no time as such. And so
yes,
you end up kind of in a Hegelian thing in which time is only what we view, but in reality it doesn't exist.
No, no. In fact, my contention is that time is such a powerful reality that unless we take it into consideration, we are dealing with no reality. So time is the only way by which change is happening, because time is change. An unchangeable phenomenon is out of time, is timeless. And in a way, there are two ways of conceiving timelessness. One is the entropic, the final entropic stillness, or the ultimate transformation of the physical into the metaphysical, into logos, into the notion of divinity. But for both cases, you need process, and process is a timely phenomenon.
Yeah, but in the end, the process has already stopped, because
yeah,
the same thing.
What you do is to
that. Well, we're part of is something which is timeless and already exists, and everything before and future where we view it already exists. So actually, time is only something that we view and not something which
has
any reality except for
us. Okay, in one paper I try to present a different kinds of metaphors for, you know, reality. One metaphor is that reality is a puzzle that is scrambled. Two ways. One is scrambled, so what we are doing, we and any kind of existence, try to unscramble the puzzle so the image will appear. The image exists, but we're not able to put it together. Or else the image exists, but is veiled by ignorance. So we have to get the dust off. So in those two cases, time is not really existent. Time is, in a way, it's a metaphor for what is happening now. So God is cleaning up the image, or we are unscrambling the scrambled puzzle by acting. But the puzzle exists, reality has been there forever, and the fundamental is unchangeable. So time is just, it's not real. But my notion is different. My notion is that since the future is non-existence, time is the element by which the future is created. So, the present is the edge of reality. Beyond that edge is nothingness, which happens to be the future. So the creational process is to edge into this nothingness by the creational process, and eventually through the consumption of the media, which is mass, time, space, mass, energy, and time, space, we exhaust the possibility of change. Which means we terminate. But the termination of time means that whatever has been before is somehow collapsed into this last instance. Otherwise, you don't have a consumption of time, you have an exhaustion of time. And time has to be, everything that has happened before has to be present in order for time to have exhausted.
So through existing in time, you're just adding on to things which.
But you're really creating.
Creating and accumulating all of time.
Well, yeah, we are already beginning through technology again to have this recall, this ability to recall. We register sounds, we register images, we register thoughts, books, and so on. So there is already an evidence that we're beginning to reach back and pull, but that we're pulling our only abstractions from the past. But somehow the past is not faded away, it exists, it's just, but it's it's barricaded somehow, or it's stored away because of this time sequence. Well, if this time sequence exhausts itself, then the barricade collapses and timelessness comes in.
As far as evolution goes, first you speak of, in your mind, the Big Bang and a certain process of evolution towards consciousness. Do you think once consciousness comes into existence, then it's through consciousness that evolution continues? In other words, would you say that now that man is conscious and starts having an effect on his world, that evolution as far as, physical evolution independent of man ceases?
It doesn't cease because even now, even though we are the species of the earth, we are still dealing with everything else which lives and grows and reproduces. But what the appearance of consciousness has done is to begin to question and to begin to anticipate. So while this creature lives only in the present, moment after moment, I live in the past and in the future, because I have a mind, and the mind cannot refrain from projecting into what has been and projecting what will be. So I vaguely know that tomorrow morning I'm going to do this and this and this. I vaguely know then within a month I'm going to do this and this and this, unless catastrophe comes about. So I am not only anticipating, I'm already living in the future. And once we have that kind of animal existing, then it cannot avoid to interfere or to inject its own will into the evolutionary process.
Do you view, you mentioned at one time in your talk that you saw your role kind of as creating possible alternatives. Do you see that as kind of the role of man in evolution, of creating possibilities which then will either fit into the process or not and be abandoned or
taken under? The scheming mind is a very risky instrument. And so, in a way, the more we move into mentation, or whatever you want to call it, the more the risk of doing the wrong thing is going to be there, which is, again, part of the unavoidable anguish that we are in. But you can't. There's no way by which you can say, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to behave. We're going to be the stewards of what exists.